SCP-9900, single file. What is the meaning of life? It's a question that has plagued mankind since our inception and has had countless answers. To serve God, to make the world a better place, to improve others' lives, 42, nothing, or everything. In The Conspiracy Against the Human Race, Thomas Ligotti writes that we know we are alive and know we will die. We also know we will suffer during our lives before suffering, slowly or quickly, as we draw near to death. This is the knowledge we enjoy as the most intelligent organisms to gush from the womb of nature. And being so, we feel shortchanged if there is nothing else for us than to survive, reproduce, and die. We want there to be more to it than that, or to think there is. SCP-9900 is an anomaly about existence and a potential reward at the end of it, even if it takes a hell of a long time to get it. Let's take a look. SCP-9900 has the unique object class of Expectate, and the containment procedures state that it does not require containment. The Foundation's current objective focuses on increasing and maintaining an active presence within it in an effort to reach the front. 9900 is a single-file line that exists outside of baseline reality, currently containing an estimated 5,230,027 humanoid individuals. It has never been successfully measured in full due to regulations enforced by 9900-1 instances. The line weaves through both anomalous dimensions and baseline reality in no identifiable pattern. The environments that surround it are both recognizable biomes and non-endemic environs, with the majority of environments it passes through being anomalous in origin. Whenever the end of the line appears within baseline reality, new individuals are able to join it. An individual who joins the line is referred to as a candidate, and the only way to join the line is to locate its end and join there. Any other attempts to join the line will fail. Whenever a candidate joins, they will understand the following facts about themselves and the line. They are waiting. They will not be waiting forever. There is a reward or something desirable that they are waiting for. If they leave the line, they can never rejoin, and only a limited number of people will get to access the reward. I believe this is the same sign posted in front of every ride at Disney World. Upon joining the line, candidates will undergo a number of physiological changes. They will immediately cease all cellular respiration, metabolic processes, and organic senescence. Candidates failing to respire for durations longer than 5 minutes will experience diaphragm contractions and pleuritic pains. After 6 hours, candidates will no longer be able to undergo urinary or digestive excretion, and they report a constant sensation of related discomfort that appears to abate over time. After a few days, candidates will begin to experience symptoms consistent with minor dehydration, but drinking will have no effect. This discomfort is ameliorated over time via correlated euphoria. After 20 days, candidates will begin to experience symptoms consistent with moderate sleep deprivation. They may sleep while adhering to the rules of the line, but they will no longer undergo REM sleep. After a couple of months, candidates will begin to experience symptoms consistent with minor starvation. Symptoms are psychological only, such as expressing a desire for their favorite foods, but consumption of any organic material will result in emesis of a gray, viscous fluid within 15 minutes. Lastly, after around 5 years in the line, candidates will no longer experience any of the discomforts, with the cause of this change being unknown. The line was first rediscovered by the Foundation in 1957, during routine patrols of extraplanar regions. At that time, the line was around 78% of its current length. Since discovery, the Foundation's prime directive focuses on supporting the effort to be first in line. In addition to the physiological changes, candidates appear to be governed by a set of common rules, although the method of enforcement is currently unknown. The list of rules was found on a document recovered from the remains of a candidate. If you leave the line, you can't rejoin. There are no exceptions, and this restriction is eternal. No cutting allowed, and you can't force another individual to leave the line or save a spot for somebody else. You can trade or barter with others, but the payment cannot include changes in position within the line. If you try to kill another person in line and are caught by them, you will be executed. You don't need to be alive to stay in the line. Do not attack them. No sleeping for longer than 10 minutes. Lastly, you must yearn to be closer to the front. The line was first discovered by Foundation employees in February of 1953, when Agent Eliana Red joined the end of the line during routine off-hours activities. At the time, she was accompanied by researcher Thea Chambers. We're given a transcript of a conversation between the two that took place outside of a dive bar in an adjacent alley. Red asks if she really thinks that this is an opportunity, and Chambers says that she does. Red has discovered a new anomaly, one that seems to reveal more to people who are waiting in the line. Red asks if she's going to join the line too, but Chambers doesn't think that it's a good idea. Now that they know it's anomalous, she can't justify the risk. They don't even know what it's done to Red, let alone if she can even leave the line. She'll walk beside her, though, documenting the anomaly, and she won't abandon her. Red says that she's stuck in it now, but she'll follow standard protocol and make recordings. Chambers says that once they have it all figured out, she'll get in touch with command and they'll be able to leave, but they have to stay until they do. This could make their careers. Red understands that and thanks Chambers for staying with her, as they'll have this figured out in no time. While Agent Red prioritized integration into the line and capturing personal accounts of other candidates through her tape recorder, Chambers began to write initial documentation, reports, and surveys of the line. She writes that walking alongside Agent Red has been a challenge in survival, and she is one of a limited few who chose to walk alongside somebody. Having spanned access tunnels, native swamps, anomalous deserts, and industrial wastelands, the only consistency has been the line. The core issue is that she cannot trust anything said by a candidate. Her current hypothesis is that the line has cognitohazardous, compulsive effects. There are far too many unknowns still, and as much as they have a professional history, she doesn't believe that Agent Red can be trusted entirely at this time. She will maintain friendly relations and help her continue her mission, but will begin to test the boundaries of the line's rules. The supply of test subjects is endless, and she believes her research should rapidly accelerate accordingly. We're given a tape recording retrieved in spring 1961, believed to have been recorded within the initial weeks of Red's candidacy. A note was attached to the canister reading, "All we remember are broad strokes. We cling to memories, surviving as echoes of tropes as we distract each other from who we once were. Our nostalgia becomes our existence." If anyone's looking for a high school yearbook quote, I think we've got a winner here. In the recording, Red asks an older woman if she's all right, after another candidate named Marcos tripped her. Red tells him to apologize to her, but the man asks why he would do that, as they're all waiting and he's not missing out on the prize. It's survival of the fittest. The older woman tells her not to bother, but Red insists, telling him that it's about compassion for his fellow man. Marcos counters that she doesn't get it yet, but she will. She hasn't messed up like he has, constantly punished by everybody. No matter where he is, the world seems to hate him for being himself. He's arbitrarily punished for arbitrary rules he couldn't possibly predict. They sent him backwards in the line because he took a nap. He's making his own justice. Red asks who they are, as they're all waiting in a line together. Marcos snickers and says that they're not. They're competing with each other, literally vying for position. The line is just a way of measuring how much you deserve the reward. He belongs at the front. Red tells him that she's sure he thinks so, but the reality is that they all deserve the same chance at the reward. That's what keeps them hopeful and keeps them human. If he hurts her again, she'll make sure he pays for it. Marcos isn't intimidated, though, as they both know fighting is against the rules. What's she going to do? Lock him up? Red just says that there's no need, as he's already trapped here, and already contained. The earliest recorded mention of 9900 was recovered from a Trappist monastery in Belgium, estimated to have been composed around 1130 CE. One translated excerpt reads, "Await the command of the Lord. We maintain our watch along the spine of the morning star, 30 strong. We need not for sustenance, nor rest. Truly, this is a blessing. We no longer see the end, nor could we ever see the beginning. We attend to his holy word and participate within his holy order." We're then given multiple recovered items throughout history related to the line. One is a carved effigy from around 700 BCE, representing a previously unknown pagan deity, potentially associated with harvests, due to visual similarity between the limbs and tools used for harvesting. The bloodstains indicate that this object may have been used in rituals by primitive candidates to appease a perceived force that created the line. Another is a collection of Greek coins from 450 BCE, commonly associated with Charon, the ferryman of the underworld. These were used by candidates as a bargaining item, due to perceived requirements of the anomaly. A recovered star chart from around 120 CE doesn't match any other known charts of astronomical objects, and a number of star clusters have been indicated as important. It's believed that this star chart has connections to a movement within 9900 purporting extraterrestrial origins. There's also a journal containing the personal notes of Arnaud Dupont, a French nobleman who disappeared in 1641. Within it, Dupont details his analysis of the line through Cartesianism, concluding that the line is a product of collective belief. It's unknown whether Dupont remains a candidate. Lastly, a scrap of leather from 1960, most likely human in origin, is inscribed with the text, "I miss your touch. Will you be there when I arrive?" Attempts by the Foundation to reach the origin of 9900 have failed, and it remains unknown what waits at the terminus of the line. Researcher Chambers' observational reports on Agent Red note that her behavior has diverged significantly from her typically professional demeanor over the past 9 months. In a redwood forest, likely in California, Red was observed sitting down on a log beside an older male individual. The older male began to cry, and Red did not react, but after a moment, she began to console the candidate. In a crystalline cavern, Red was noted as ceasing writing standard status reports on her mental state. She claims that this is because there is no point, and Chambers questions if this is insubordination. In a defunct subway station, Red disclosed her awareness of the paranormal to a fellow candidate, but the candidate died before the information could be spread. In some underground tunnels at Disney World, Red was consoling the child of a candidate who had just been executed by the force governing the line. Rather than continuing the recording, Red turned off her tape recorder. Suspecting that Red had been compromised, Chambers continued her observation and analysis of her behavior, following from a distance to remove any potential influence on Red's actions. After 12 weeks of analysis, she approached Red for the final time in an attempt to mitigate the cognitohazard. Red asks where the hell she's been, and Chambers says that she was evaluating other candidates to further their research. She's simply following procedure for Red's benefit, as their mission is important. Red replies that she has the same basic training as her, so she sees what Chambers is trying. She thought they were in this together, so she asks what changed. Chambers says that while Red has been waiting, she has been continuing their mission, so that she can properly understand the anomaly. She thinks she can save the world with it. She just has to make sure that she's analyzing every avenue. She has been analyzing the rules and how they impact the candidates, attempting to understand why some are sent back while others are killed, let alone how the consequences come to be. Red is sure that she's getting some great insights watching them from a safe distance, but Chambers replies that she's begun speaking to other candidates directly. The dialogue has been immensely helpful in understanding the desires and impulses of candidates. Red tells her that she can't BS her, as she's doing exactly what she's supposed to, presenting just enough info so that Red gives her what she wants without compromising the integrity of the project. She would normally run tests with D-Class, but she has these candidates instead. Chambers assures her that anything she's done has been within standard testing protocols, and she's doing it for her sake. Red argues that she can't justify that, as these are people, but Chambers replies that they are anomalies. Chambers takes out a notebook and begins to take notes, asking if they're aligned on the mission or not, but Red says that she doesn't even see her as a person anymore, just seeing them all as part of the line. Chambers replies that she's worried about her, as she's not acting like herself, and they're on the same side. Red, however, says that she doesn't think they are, and tells her not to talk to her again. She tells her to go home and go back to the Foundation with her research. She doesn't care anymore. Chambers later writes that her suspicions have been confirmed, that 9900 influences candidates to turn against their own beliefs through cognitohazardous means. Therefore, any future agents embedded within the line should undergo cognitohazard resistance training and require a minimum milligram score of 95% or higher. This is to ensure that embedded agents remain loyal to the Foundation's objectives. As she can no longer rely on Agent Red, she plans to redouble her efforts in understanding candidates and the rules governing them. Early tests have shown promising results, and she is certain they hold the key to controlling the line. While the way things were left between herself and Red is regrettable, she will not allow it to impact her objectivity. Once she has a full understanding of the line and how they can use it, she will contact Command and then extraction can be discussed. We're given a brief log of tests performed by Chambers, starting with her attempting to push a candidate out of line. The candidate was pushed a few feet, but remaining within the line, with them reacting marginally. Second, a subject was influenced to attempt cutting in line, but they were bisected vertically by an unseen force. Another was provided with a knife, at which point they successfully eliminated three candidates without drawing attention. On attacking the fourth, however, an unseen force dragged the individual out of line, where they were drawn and quartered. Another attempted to push a different candidate out of line, but they were held in place by an unknown force, while the instigator was anomalously dragged backwards until they had lost approximately 200 positions. Lastly, another subject was provided with masonry equipment and instructed to weaken the cliff that the line ran along. Six candidates later, the cliff collapsed, killing approximately 30 candidates. The line was immediately rerouted to avoid the new obstacle, via a tunnel which appeared through the rock face. The subject remained unharmed. Another voice recording from Red was recovered in June of 2006, believed to have been recorded after Chambers' departure. A note was found attached to it reading, "You're never lonely in the line. A time capsule, stuck, surrounded by everything you once knew. Something that should never change, right? Before you understand the consequences for breaking the rules. Before you see the punishments every time you close your eyes. Before you can see them." A crackling sound can be heard in the background of the recording, as well as unknown bird calls. Red asks someone named Dubois if that's a campfire, but he says that it's a funeral pyre. Someone else named Isabel asks if anyone else remembers the last time they were at a funeral, but Red just asks why they're burning the body instead of burying them. There's silence around the fire, until Isabel says that once an adjudicator is done with you, there are too many pieces to bury. Someone else named Nathan says that they shouldn't be talking about them, and tells the others to just take a moment and remember. Dubois says that he misses seeing his daughter, with her hair tied up, as she's waist deep in a bog with a huge grin across her face. He swears that he sees her face somewhere off in the line at least once a month. A woman named Jean says that she misses movie theaters, being able to put the rest of her life on pause for an hour or two, escaping into a story that would have a beginning, middle, and ending. And she misses endings. Nathan says that he misses his job, the routine, the smell of the shop, the smoke breaks, and Isabel agrees. It's not the big things she misses, it's the little things. She misses having choices. Red finally speaks again, saying that she misses having a purpose, feeling like she had some meaning in life. She used to have a goal, aspirations, an objective beyond just survival. Here, she's just waiting. She feels like she lost everything the moment she joined the line. Dubois tells her that she still has her life, and she can still get her reward. Isabel says that surviving in the line is a struggle, a fight for your life, just like it was before. Every day you have to choose to persist, but at least here, your neighbors understand, and you're never alone. Nathan tells her that she has all of them, and the entire line, and they all understand exactly what she's feeling. Red can be heard crying. In another note from Chambers, she writes that after nearly a decade of research, she has finally found a drawing that she believes addresses how the rules of the line are enforced. This is the proof she needed, the evidence that there are entities enforcing the rules, and she believes they may be able to take advantage of the entities. If she can understand how the rules are determined, she should be able to change them, and if she can do that, maybe she can make Red see the truth. 9900-1 instances, referred to by candidates as adjudicators, are entities that enforce the rules of the line. They are imperceptible to all but the candidates, and have an unknown origin. Due to the inability to capture photographic evidence of them, we only have verbal and written descriptions. They possess an avian head, with nearly translucent skin covering the bone. They don't possess eyes, and their beak does not open. Their torso is mammalian, composed of limestone or a similar compound, and they possess four legs, covered in jagged points, composed of the same material as the torso. Their arms have three segments, each composed of the same material, with the final segment being long, narrow, and regularly kept in a vertical orientation. Attached to the third arm segment is a sharp protrusion, between 3 to 5 feet long, tapering to a point. A membrane connects the endpoint to the pseudo-wrist, sharpened to a cutting edge. The membrane has been noted as carving through stone, metal, and bone with ease. They do not appear to have a circadian rhythm, nor have they been observed to sleep. They appear to be constantly shedding and regenerating the material that constitutes the majority of their body, and they appear to draw sustenance from the anomaly itself, through unknown methods. They are also capable of vocalization, with modulation of tone, despite no visible syrinx. As for their personality, they seem to exhibit signs of sadism, hatred, and spite. We're given another voice log recovered in 1994, and believed to have been recorded between 1955 and 65. Red reports that she's in what appears to be a forest, and the line is much more isolated here. She thinks this is what others have called a slow segment. She can't see the person ahead of her, but she knows the path forward, and that the next candidate is just a few steps ahead. A loud bird song is then heard, not matching any recorded birds within the Foundation's databases. Red asks if that's an adjudicator, as a gurgling chirp is heard, amidst an atonal birdsong sounding like a scratched record. It gets louder until labored breathing can be heard, but Red says that she still doesn't see it. The breathing continues as the other sounds fade until the only audible sounds are Red's breathing and the unknown entity's breathing. Red whispers and asks if it is waiting too. Chambers submitted a proposal to the O5 Council for utilizing the adjudicator instances as humanoid anomaly containment. In her proposal, she states that they present a unique opportunity to the Foundation, as not only are they physically strong, but they adhere to a predictable set of rules and regulations. Once the Foundation has established control over 9900, she proposes that the Q be used as containment for humanoid anomalies, regardless of object class. This would reduce the space used for containment, and would allow the Foundation to establish a stronger presence in 9900 through proxies. She believes that they may be able to either manipulate, directly change, or influence the rules that are enforced within 9900 once a Foundation presence within it gains critical mass. By utilizing it for containment, they would not only save billions per year, but they would be saving lives. Sure seems like she's putting the cart before the horse. Her proposal was naturally rejected, based on her outdated perception of containment. However, based on her independent research of the line and her prolonged loyalty to the Foundation, she received a field promotion to senior researcher. She was instructed to continue identifying methods of control, while the Foundation renewed efforts to embed agents within the line. Another recording was recovered, with a note reading, "I still think a lot about what you said. When you accused me of betrayal, it hurt. More than your betrayals, because this time I knew you meant it. You're just as helpless as I am, aren't you? Stuck. When did you decide my fate for me? When I first joined? What gave you that right?" Red tells an older man named Ernest that he can move ahead, as they're in a fast segment and they need to stay together. Ernest thanks her and says that he hasn't been in this line for very long, but he has truly come to appreciate the people who surround him. It's been less than a week, and already he feels like he can consider all of them family. Red is shocked for him to say that it's been less than a week, but a younger woman named Kara tells him that it's been longer than that. Ernest remembers that it has been, but not much longer, and he thanks Kara for helping him keep track of everything. There's just so much to remember. After a pause in conversation, Ernest says that he'll sit down and close his eyes for a short time. He tells Kara to wake him in 30, but Kara says that it's 10 minutes now, as she guesses they weren't happy about the gaps. Ernest groans and tells her to wake him in 9 then. Red then talks to Kara alone, saying that it seems like Ernest is almost detached from reality, and asks if everything is okay with him. Kara says that it's complicated. Physically, he's as healthy as a 68-year-old in the line can be, with his health almost frozen in time. He's had the same cough for years, with it not getting worse or better. Red replies that if you can move, you can stay here forever, but why does he seem to think he's only been waiting for a week? Kara explains it as early stages of dementia, with him getting his diagnosis right before he joined the line. It wasn't much at first, with him not saying anything about it, and he was still working when he found the line. Red asks if they were co-workers, but Kara says that she's his daughter, causing Red to apologize. He was still going to work, every day, 5 days a week, the same job for 30 years, doing the same thing in the same office in the town he grew up in. He loved routine and lived his life the same way for decades, with the only change being the rest of the world. Red replies that that sounds like a nightmare, and Kara agrees, as she moved away when she was 21, with dreams that were bigger than their little community. Red asks how they ended up in the line, and she says that she got a letter from him. Apparently, the line had gone past a mailbox, and he managed to slip it in during a moment of lucidity. It asked for her to come and help, so she did everything she could to find him. She found the line, and maybe it was fate or messed up genetics, but she found it and joined it. She waited for months, hoping that her dad was waiting too, and she was already ready to leave when she found him. Same suspenders, same slacks, same glasses, and the same optimistic look on his face. He explained the line to her, like they were both new, and she didn't tell him that she was his daughter for a week at least. She stopped trying after the 30th time, as it hurt too much. Red asks how long she's wanted to leave the line, and she says since she joined it, but she can't leave him. He doesn't feel the same way about the line, though. It's like work, but better. He just stands around all day, and the stuff they see is always new to him. She's jealous. Red suggests that at least she gets to spend time with him, causing her to snort and say that they get to spend an eternity waiting in a line. Red remarks that you never know the last time that you're going to see your family, but Kara wishes that she could see the eternity with the dad she remembered, not the dad who forgets who she is every single day. But at least she knows that if they left, he would only get worse. Kara asks her how long she's been in the line, and Red says 1953, a long time. She asks if Red has a family waiting for her out there, but Red says that she hopes they're not waiting for her. She doesn't deserve that, and neither do they. In another research note from Chambers, she writes that the previous understanding of the line was that candidates can only move forwards when another candidate leaves or is removed, or backwards when breaking a minor rule. Recently, she has discovered that there are methods of moving ahead in the line without breaking Rule 2, the no-cutting rule. It appears that by assisting the adjudicators in identifying rule breakers, or otherwise ensuring the rules are enforced, candidates will be rewarded and moved ahead within the line. The severity of the rule broken appears to dictate how far you are moved ahead, from a marginal adjustment to significant shifts. This contributes to the seemingly chaotic migration of candidates. In her attempts to fully survey candidate migration, she has uncovered an additional difficulty in tracking the line. As candidates cross the midway point of the line, they begin to abstract from tangible reality, appearing to fade. This fading also impacts the environs surrounding the line, and is hypothesized to be a form of anomalous camouflage, similar to that of the adjudicators. As a result, she has been unable to observe the line beyond the midpoint. Therefore, she recommends that any embedded agents assist adjudicators in enforcing the rules to accelerate their forward movement. It is critical that they gain direct insights into the line beyond the fading point. While other candidates may object to this kind of intervention, the majority do not appear to care. Foundation training in enforcing normalcy will be directly applicable in this context, and initial tests have been promising. We're given another audio log from Red, recovered within Chambers' personal effects following her passing in 2019. Red quietly says that she thinks she just saw somebody in line use magic, low-level thaumaturgy, so she's going to talk to them. Red approaches the woman, named Megan, and asks if she can ask her a weird question. She asks if she's a member of the Serpent's Hand, and after a pause, Megan says that she'll show hers if Red shows hers. She asks if Red is Foundation then, and Red says that she used to be. Megan pauses and says that normally she'd spit at her and try and mess with her mission, but what's the point? They're all friends here. Red replies that for whatever it's worth, she doesn't really have a mission anymore. Megan asks if she's not here to dominate the line under the Foundation's cold, not cruel heel, but Red just snorts and says that she doesn't think they know she exists. Honestly, she's glad, as she wishes they didn't exist either. She asks if Megan misses the hand, but she says not really. She hasn't done anything for the hand in a long time, so they're more like her vestigial tail that she cut off years ago. She asks if Red misses the Foundation, but Red just says that she thinks she misses being a part of something bigger. Megan asks if she misses being part of a colonialist, authoritarian regime that enforces normalcy, but Red says that she just misses having somebody that she could rely on, somebody who she could trust with her life. Megan asks when the last time she talked with somebody from back then, and Red says that there was a researcher who was walking the line with her, back when she discovered it, until she decided that containing anomalies was more important than her promise to her. Megan says that that sounds like a shitty friend, and asks where she is now. Red replies that she's still watching the line, still studying her to this day. She thinks that Red doesn't notice her, keeping her distance, but she just wishes she would talk to her again. Megan tells her that she can talk to her at any time. Anything that used to matter, friends, lovers, obligations, don't mean anything here. They don't need it, though, as they're all bound together by one invisible ribbon, each and every one of them that stands here, waiting. Like she said, they're all friends here. She's interrupted by a male voice, who laughs loudly and asks if she really thinks that this life is any different just because they're all in a line. Red recognizes him as Marcos and tells Megan to just ignore him. Marcos asks if she thinks this is some sort of hippie commune, that they all want the same things, so they must understand each other on some deeper level. There's still winners, and there's certainly still losers. They're surrounded by losers, corpses that couldn't handle waiting, cowards who gave up. It's still a competition, just like the real world. Megan says that in the real world, they have poverty, hunger, wars, capitalism, homophobia, and Marcos cuts her off, saying that of course she would be one of those, chuckling that nothing was ever her fault. He's trying to do them both a favor. They might be surrounded by towers of stone and pillars of salt, but you can't change human nature. There will always be those who are superior, and there will always be competition. Red says that he needs that, doesn't he? He needs to pretend like he mattered, and she bets that he used to brag about his job, his money, his cars. He's so arrogant he couldn't even realize that he's still lying to himself. The fact is that he's broken, and he can't even admit it. He's been standing in a line for over 20 years, and he still thinks that the real world matters more. Marcos replies that clearly she doesn't know what she's talking about, but she cuts him off and says that she knows exactly what he's talking about. He felt powerful, but no matter who he was, she can guarantee that she was more important. She could have erased him from the world with a smile on her face and gotten a reward for it. She played the game better than he ever did. None of that matters, and it's all made up. Things we create to help us get through the day. One more promotion, one more house, a new car, all of these stupid goals we cling to because we think they make our lives mean something. Megan says that we are what gives life meaning. People. Not ideas, not things, other human beings. Red agrees, but Marco says that they can pretend as much as they like, dream that nothing really matters, but it doesn't change the fact that he's going to get to the front of the line, and they won't. It's a simple fact. Megan swears after he leaves, and asks if Red is okay. She says that she is, and after a pause, says that she was just thinking about something. Megan tells her not to let him get to her, as she's better than that. Systems are just somebody else's ideal. He's too stupid to ever see through it, and he'll never realize that wealth and power are meaningless. Red just replies that it's all meaningless, and Megan says that the line is pure reality, just people in a place talking to each other. They're part of something bigger than themselves, all equal in the line. They get to mean something here. Red questions if they do. The origins of 9900 remain unknown, and as a result, the original purpose behind its creation is not understood. This has the additional effect of there not being clues towards the nature of the reward at the end. While candidates speculate, there has been no confirmed contact with a candidate who reached the end of the line. It is currently believed that the further along the line a candidate progresses, the more information they understand about the anomaly. This has been shown through candidates further along having better understanding of the rules and more specific beliefs regarding the reward. While no intentionally embedded agent has crossed the midpoint, Red is believed to be the closest asset to the threshold. While direct contact has been delayed, by request of senior researcher Chambers, it is critical that her loyalty is ensured prior to losing contact. Another log was found placed on a makeshift grave beside the line, believed to have been recorded around 1982. The recording begins midway through a bird call, and Red asks if they understand her when she talks to them. She asks why they follow the rules, why they make them follow the rules. Do they even know what the rules are, or is this just an instinct? The chorus accelerates the tune, as additional entities join the song. Red says that she doesn't know why she's asking, as she guesses she just hoped that somehow they might have been like her. The chorus lowers their volume, and a single adjudicator begins to vocalize a pattern of chirps, coughs, and screams. The melody is strained. Red just says that she wishes they would answer her. A moment later, she attempts to sing along with the melody, and the birdsong cuts out abruptly. Wind blows in the background as no other sounds are heard. Red laughs that she shed her shackles to join a chain gang. She hasn't learned anything. Maybe the end of the line will teach her what it all means. We're then provided a notice of resignation from Chambers, in which she states that complacent is the best way to describe the candidates. Despite the discomfort experienced and the constant unending labor involved in waiting within the line, candidates persist. After nearly four decades of research, she is convinced that candidates are cognitohazardly influenced to prioritize advancement within the line. Comparing the nebulous and unattainable reward to common motivations within baseline reality, such as a promotion or monetary compensation, logic dictates that the tangible rewards should be more appealing. However, despite this, when offered monetary compensation for their departure from the line, candidates have unanimously rejected her offers, noting that they will soon be closer to the end. This doesn't make sense. Even with her prolonged research and extensive notes, she doesn't feel as though she understands why candidates act the way that they do any better than when Red and her first found the anomaly. She wonders if Red has insights that could help them understand how the cognitohazard works, tell them why candidates seem to no longer care about anything but forward progress. But she knows she can't approach her. Not after this long, not after the way Chambers left things, and even if she did, would Red talk to her? Is she still loyal after all these years? Maybe Chambers is just jaded, tired, and ready to come home. Whatever discoveries lie further along the line, those are no longer hers to unveil. She hopes to one day see their containment goals fully realized, so that they can change the fate of the world, but she leaves that in the capable hands of the 9900 research team. We then have the most recently recovered audio log to date. Based on the lack of environmental damage to the canister, they believe that this recording was made between 3 to 6 months prior to recovery. A note was found attached to it, reading simply, "I give up." Red states that she's making a recording, but she doesn't know why anymore. It's a habit, like the people who tap their feet while they wait or keep track of their footsteps. It's pointless, but somehow it provides some small comforts. Or rather, it did. There was a minor tunnel collapse along the line's path, just ahead of her, but she hasn't been rerouted yet. She doesn't think this was an accident, as their song told her that they were coming to collect on something long overdue. She pauses and says that she's found a body. She's going to try and pull it out so that they can at least have a proper burial. There's then a minute of silence before she says that she knows him. It's Marcos, and she guesses that he wasn't any better than them in the end. She should feel something, she knows, as even at her worst, a small part of her would feel remorseful when killing on a mission. The innocence that didn't die, crying out each time, wishing that circumstances could have been different. They tried to numb her, but it never took. She just got better at hiding it. Here, she had to leave all of that behind. She thought that people were her reason now, that the community was what mattered. She would mourn each person who didn't make it to the end, bury whatever remained of the candidates that couldn't cut it. She had friends, a found family. She needed to matter to them. She couldn't live standing around waiting just for herself. She needed people who could count on her, rely on her to be there for them. She needed other people to give her life meaning. She held on to that for the first half of her wait, like a safety blanket. She begins to cry before stopping abruptly. She says that she never needed any of this. She just thought she did. She's not hungry anymore because she doesn't want to eat. She doesn't need to sleep because it's pointless. She's abandoned so many things that are imaginary. The last few tethers that kept her to reality. Now she's adrift, staring at the corpse of somebody who she once hated, feeling absolutely nothing. She's then heard walking, and she says that she should catch up. The line is waiting for her. Following the recovery of that log in September of 2024, Foundation attempts to locate Red were redoubled in hopes that direct contact could be established prior to her impending disappearance. MTF teams were dispatched to the dead drop location and began to follow the line. Within 3 weeks, Red was identified based on an exact match to her Foundation ID. MTF Captain Quinn Chambers received authorization from command, with instructions to attempt to confirm Red's loyalty to the Foundation and encourage her to remain within the line. Failing that, Quinn was instructed to compel her to exit the line, returning to Foundation control, such that her experiences could be extracted. On September 19th, 2024, Red was approached by Quinn. His body camera shows that the candidates in line are all varying levels of transparency, and the environment surrounding them is similarly faded. The only exception is Red, who can be seen clearly. Quinn approaches and asks if she's Agent Eliana Red, to which she just says that she guesses so. Quinn introduces himself and says that he's here to make good on an old promise. The Foundation has been looking for her for a long time now. He asks if she's okay, and she finally turns to glance at him, snorting that she just started to feel a pain in her ass. She tells him to drop the act and get to his point. Quinn says that he knows that she's been by herself for a long time, and he can't imagine what she's gone through. He's been sent to check on her and report back to the Foundation about her mission. He asks if he can check her vitals, but she tells him not to bother. She hasn't had a pulse in years, let alone a mission. She asks him why they sent him, and why they're trying after this long. Quinn replies that they found her logs, and she's been serving the Foundation consistently for decades, but Red cuts him off and says that the Foundation doesn't matter anymore. She's not sure if it ever did. Chambers activates the radio in his helmet and quietly says to the rescue team that Red appears to be under a compulsion of some kind. Red overhears and says that she's fine. She doesn't need a doctor or therapy or another attempt at forcing her loyalty. Quinn tells her that she is unwell and has been for a long time. Command told him to keep her in line, no matter what, but that's not what she needs. She needs to escape this, and he knows that it can be hard to just let go of something that you've been clinging onto as a lifeline for so long. Sometimes their missions become a crutch, whether or not they call it that. They become an obsession, the only way they make it through the day. He knows what she's going through, and he wants to help. Red asks if he really wants to help, and he says that he does. She survived and succeeded, going above and beyond what anybody at the Foundation could have ever expected. But her fight is over now, and she can relax. She can finally let go. She's going to come in from the cold and be celebrated as a hero. He removes his helmet and puts a hand on her shoulder, as he says that he knows it can be terrifying. He's been in deep cover before, and sometimes you do the same thing for so long that you can't imagine a world without your mission. You start to exist exclusively for a purpose. It gets you through the worst moments, telling yourself that what you are doing will be worth it in the end. But now she is at the end. She's not alone. He's here with her. There's a moment of silence before Red breathes a dry chuckle. She says that he's still telling the same lies all these years later. She doesn't think he understands, that there's nothing to go back to. Quinn assures her that she has a place at the Foundation, but she says that she doesn't care, asking what the point is. Quinn sighs and removes a folded photograph from his pocket. He says that this is a picture of him and his parents, and sometimes when he's in the middle of nothingness, he looks at it and remembers what he does this for. His mom taught him to persist, no matter what. He asks her about her family, and if she still thinks about them, but she doesn't. Quinn says that his mom told him about what she used to be like, and he's heard the stories for years, but this isn't her. She's been brainwashed into believing that waiting in this line is all that matters. Part of this obsession that everybody who encounters the line shares. She needs to wake up. Red just asks again why she would bother, as there is nothing out there for her. Quinn asks if not even the slightest part of her misses the real world, but she says no. She doesn't care about the line. She doesn't care about waiting. She doesn't care about him, herself, or anybody else in this godforsaken queue. She doesn't care anymore. Quinn says that she's been gone for 70 years, so it's understandable that she's feeling conflicted. Red tells him not to patronize her, as it's never worked. He asks what he's supposed to do, but she just tells him to leave. She tells him not to talk to her again, and to go back to his family. Tell the Foundation whatever he wants, as it won't change anything. Quinn replies that he's not going to abandon her. He'll be back every day until she remembers how much the world matters. Red says again for him not to bother, as the only thing that she wants to know is what's at the end of the line. It's the only certain thing, the only thing she cares about, the only thing that matters. She reaches into her pocket and throws the tape recorder and a note onto the ground, which Quinn picks up. She tells him to take those back to his commanders, as she doesn't need them, and to say hello to his mother. Quinn replies that he can't, as she's dead, but Red doesn't react. He hesitates before turning away. That was the last sighting of Agent Eliana Red. Embedded Foundation agents within 9900 have been instructed to make contact if possible, so that she might resume employment. The note she threw down shows a spiral with a dot partway along the line, and the words next to it read, "You are still here." It's easy, I think, for most people to have their lives fall into a grand routine. We wake up, we go to work, we go home, we eat, we sleep, we do it again, in one long line of ingrained emotions, without much to break it up. It's even easier, of course, for a guy on a YouTube video to point this out to people, as listeners say, "He's right, you know. My life is a routine, and I should try to change that. After all, what's the point of living if you're just waiting around to die?" That brings us, of course, back to the grand question at the start, the universal question that will never cease to plague us, of what the meaning of life is. For religious-minded individuals, it's to spread the word of God and be a representation of their goodness on earth before passing and being rewarded in the afterlife. For atheists, it's generally to try to make the world a better place or enjoy the time they have here before they shuffle off this mortal coil and the lights go out. For many, however, purpose is a concept that requires no thought or effort, as the purpose of being alive is to be alive, to wake up and go to work and come home to sleep before doing it again. Life is nothing more than a series of distractions to occupy our minds so that we don't spend our time pondering our mortality and its purpose. The line of SCP-9900 is certainly a metaphor for life, and much like the Foundation will likely never discover what the grand reward is at the end of it, neither will humanity likely discover if there's any rewards at the end of our lives. That certainly doesn't stop people in the line from believing in it, however, even if it comes to be the only thing they care about. Their purpose has become waiting, and nothing more, passing the time for years and years with nothing to show for it, except being a bit closer to the end. Perhaps, after hundreds and hundreds of years, when they get to the end of the line, it'll all be worth it. Or perhaps, to quote Becker, life is a series of disappointments, followed by one big one.